So I left off with the concept of osmolality. Forget, you know, difference between osmolality, osmolarity. That's, you know, that's garbage stuff. So it's a measure of solutes in a fluid. So you can do a urine osmolality and be the solutes that are in urine. You can do plasma, solutes in plasma. Spinal fluid, whatever. Sweat, you can do it for that too. So it's two times the sodium. So let's say the normal sodium is 140, so we're up to 280. Ooh, that's high. Okay. Now your glucose is another one that's big, and we divide that by 18. So let's say normal glucose 100, 18 to 100, roughly 5. That's not contributing a whole lot. Blood, urea, nitrogen. Who can tell me where the urea cycle is located? Liver. And part of it's in the cytosol, part of it's in the mitochondria. And what is it? Where did urea come from? Ammonia. Okay, that's how we get rid of ammonia. And the end product of the urea cycle is urea, but it's ammonia that's fed into the system. So that's how we get rid of ammonia, which is, of course, very toxic. Okay, let's say the normal is about 12, 3 and 12, 4. So what is responsible for, in a normal person, our plasma osmolality? Sodium. Basically, the rule of thumb is you double the serum sodium and add 10. That would be roughly what the measured osmolality would be. All right, that's concept one. All right, now, two of these three things are limited to the ECF compartment. One of them, if it's increased, can equilibrate between the ECF and ICF across the cell membranes. Which one is that? Urea. So if urea is increased, that can equilibrate between the ECF and ICF, so there'll be an equal amount on both sides. Now I'm going somewhere with this, and it's the concept of osmosis. Okay? Because of the fact that sodium and glucose are limited to the ECF compartment, then changes in its concentration can result in the movement of water from where? From low to high or high to low? What is it? Low to high. Water will move from the lower side to the higher side. Just the opposite of diffusion. You better hope that we have diffusion going on in our lungs, because you have 100 millimeters of mercury in the alveolar of oxygen, okay? And returning from your tissue, you got 40 PO2. So who's bigger, 100 or 40? 100, and so by the law of diffusion, oxygen moves through the interface and dissolves in your plasma to get it up to about 95. Okay? That's diffusion. Goes from high to low. But osmosis goes from low to high. Big time mistake oftentimes made by students. Okay. So let's see if you understand that. You have hyponatremia. Which way is water going to go? Is it going to go from the ICF into the ECF or ECF into the ICF? ECF into the ICF, because the lower part is in the ECF, hyponatremia. And so water goes into the ICF compartment, so it gets expanded by the law of osmosis. Now let's make believe the brain is a single cell, just for fun. So what would we see in the brain? Cerebral edema. Would we have mental status abnormalities? Sure. So signs and symptoms of hyponatremia would be mental status abnormalities by the law of osmosis. The intracellular fluid compartment of all the cells in the brain would be expanded. Okay? Would be expanded. All right. How about if you had hypernatremia? Okay? Which way is there a gradient now between the ECF and ICF when you have hypernatremia? Sure. Which way is water going to move? Out of the ICF into the ECF. Okay? So what happens to the ICF compartment? Gets contracted. Okay? So, make believe the brain, what's going to happen to all those cells in the intracellular compartment of the cells in the brain? Contracted. What kinds of symptoms will you get there? Small thoughts versus large thoughts. No, you're going to get mental status abnormalities. Okay? You're going to get mental status. So either way, whether you have hypo or hypernatremia, you're going to get mental status. One from the brain being too, having too much water intracellularly, and then the other too little. Okay? Now, we don't have time to discuss this, nor is it on boards. The brain is very unique in that it can make ideogenic osmoles. It can actually, within a space of 48 to 72 hours, rehydrate itself anyway. So it's a very, very short-lived thing. But that's something that's not on boards, not to worry about. All right, here we go. Let's say you have diabetic ketoacidosis, and you've got 1,000 milligrams per cent blood sugar. Okay? So who's winning now is the king of osmosis. Sodium, Well, glucose. Because both glucose and sodium are limited to the ECF compartment. Now, some of you are still thinking, maybe. Maybe not. You're saying, Dr. Gulley, I never heard of glycolysis. Glycolysis occurs in the cytosol. So glucose is in the intracellular fluid compartment. No, it ain't. Where's glucose always go in with? Phosphorus. Because you know all sugars are phosphorylated to trap them in there. So glucose immediately becomes glucose-6-phosphate and is immediately metabolized. Same thing with fructose, but that's fructose-1-phosphate. Same thing is true with galactose, but that's galactose-1-phosphate. It's metabolized immediately. So there is no glucose and fructose and galactose per se intracellularly. Okay, so which way is water going to move? Come on, come on. Hyperglycemia, 1,000 milligrams. Come on. From ICF to ECF. Okay, so I'm going to, this is my ECF compartment. Normally has 140 milliequivalents of sodium in here. I'm adding pure water into this cup. And that water is coming from the ICF compartment. What happens to my serum sodium concentration? It goes down. That's called dilutional hyponatremia. And that's as far as you need to go for part one. Okay, to know what happens to the serum sodium when you have hyperglycemia. Okay. Part two, I would have taught you a little further. But we don't have to. By the way, these notes are very good for part two. Very good for part two. So you're getting two for one, actually. Okay. They're very good for part two. Especially the system stuff. Okay. So that's cool. So the two things that control water movements in the ECF compartment are sodium and glucose. But in a normal situation, who's the one? Sodium. Very good. Very good. Urea doesn't control water movements because it's permeable. It can go through both compartments and establish an equal concentration on both sides. So let's get into the concept now. I think the next slide is tonicity. Tonicity. We have isotonic state. We have a hypotonic state. And we have a hypertonic state. Okay. What does this all mean? Okay, well, we have isotonic saline, don't we? We have hypotonic salines, like half normal saline, quarter normal saline. We have plain old 5% dextrose in water. We even have hypertonic saline. We have 3%. We have 5%. Anybody know what percent normal saline is? 0.9%. Okay. So we're referring to tonicity in terms of what the normal tonicity of our plasma is. Our plasma is, which is basically controlled by your serum sodium, as you know. Okay. So, these are the three types of tonicity, isotonic, hypotonic, and hypertonic condition. Now, I'll just at this point mention the fact that when we do the serum sodium concentration in a laboratory, actually, it is a reflection of your total body sodium divided by your total body water. Now, most of you have never heard of this thing, but it is a valid concept. Okay. And this is very important for you to understand. Why? Because most of you, if I said if you had hypernatremia, would say that means your total body sodium must be increased. Because if you have an increase in serum sodium, that means your overall total body sodium is increased. I can make a hypernatremia and have a normal total body sodium by losing total body water. If I decrease that, what would that do to the serum sodium concentration? It'd increase it. See, most of you would have thought that. But it's a ratio of total body sodium to total body water. Now, I will show you how you determine total body sodium. It's not measured by any standard way of measuring. It's clinical exam that determines your total body sodium. Serum sodium, they just measure in plasma and serum. Okay, so that's easy to determine. So we'll go back to that concept, but here's the concept we want to get now. We have different kinds of fluid abnormalities where we can lose a certain tonicity of fluid or we can gain a certain tonicity of fluid. And they just go berserk on this on boards. And so you need to know what they mean by these things. So when they talk about you have an isotonic loss of fluid, okay, what would they really mean by that? Well, we look at this ratio up here to total body sodium and total body water. What it basically means is you're losing equal amounts of salt and water. Isn't that what an isotonic loss of fluid would be? Yes or no? Okay. And where would this fluid be? This isotonic fluid, would it be in your ECF and ICF compartment? Or are we talking about mainly you'd be losing it from the ECF compartment? ECF. Very good. Okay, but what would your serum sodium concentration be if you lost isotonic fluid? Normal. Okay, very good. And what would your ECF compartment look like if you lost isotonic fluid from there? Contracted. But would you have an osmotic gradient for water movement into the ICF or out of it? No. Anybody want to know, or anybody know, a clinical condition where you can get an isotonic loss of fluid? Oh, that's good. Very good. Hemorrhage would be good. What else? Diarrhea, adult diarrhea, is usually isotonic. Okay, good. Now, if we have an isotonic gain, that means we gain an equal amount of salt and water. Could anyone think of a cause of that? Someone getting too much isotonic or normal saline, okay? Instead of 3 liters, which is what you thought you put down there, you wrote 8, okay? And they gave 8 liters of isotonic saline. Hey, what would you see in sodium be? Totally normal because there's equal amount of salt and water there. But what would be, where would all that excess isotonic saline be? What compartment? ECF compartment. Would there be any osmotic gradient for water movement? No. How about some hypotonic solutions? Well, by definition, that means hyponatremia. I mean, hypoglycemia is not going to produce a hypotonic condition because, remember, it was glucose divided by 18. I mean, you can have a 40 blood glucose, 18 in the 40 is going to, like, I mean, that would be like if you're peeing into the Atlantic Ocean, is it going to turn yellow when you pee into it? No, okay? It's not going to do anything. Unless they added a dye to it, okay, and if you did pee into the water, it would change color. Okay, so that's nothing. So in other words, the most common cause of a low osmolality in plasma is hyponatremia. Okay, so how can we get a decrease in serum sodium or a hypotonic condition? Well, what if we lost more salt than water? Okay, if we lost more salt than water, what would the serum sodium be? Come on, they decreased. Okay, so how would you define that type of solution where you're losing more salt than water? Would that be a hypotonic loss of fluid, an isotonic loss of fluid, or a hypertonic loss of fluid? Ooh. And where's the main place we deal with sodium, please, to get rid of it or gain it back? The kidney. So this would have to be something involving the kidney. How about a diuretic? Do you think when you give a patient a diuretic, like a thiazide or a loop diuretic, what do you think the tonicity of that fluid is that you lose in the urine? Hypertonic. And so that's why you end up with hyponatremia and a hypotonic condition. What's your ICF compartment look like now? If you have hyponatremia, which way does water move? Come on. Into the ICF compartment. There you go. Very good. Okay. How about this situation? You just gained pure water, but no salt at all. Okay, what would that do? Well, that really lower your serum sodium. You're just gaining pure water. Okay. What do you think would be the most common cause of that? Gaining pure water and no salt. How about inappropriate ADH syndrome? Anybody know some kind of cancer that secretes ADH? It's called small cell carcinoma in the lung. They don't use the term oat cell anymore. That's an older term now. They use the term small cell carcinoma. They don't use oat because it sounds like food. Okay? And so they don't use, foods describing things anymore. Okay? Would you gain pure water? Sure, because you learned in renal physiology that ADH renders the distal collecting and collecting tubule permeable to water. What water? Free water. And so if it's ADH is present 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, you're going to be reabsorbing all that water back into your ECF compartment, diluting down your serum sodium, okay? And what would you be doing to the ECF compartment by gaining all this water? Expand it. And then what else are you going to be doing to your ICF compartment? Expanding it. So you're both ways you're out, you're expanded. Whoop! That way. Okay. Talk about mental status abnormalities. You know what that means? If I had a small cell carcinoma, what have I been drinking? Water. I would lose none of this water in my urine. Why? It'd all be sucked out before it even got to the toilet bowl. via the ADH. So the more water I drank, the lower my serum sodium. So what would be the treatment of choice for inappropriate ADH? Restrict water.
Why don't we restrict salt?
Why would you want to do that? Your total body sodium is normal. The problem is you're waterlogged. ADH is there, and you're constantly reabsorbing water. Can you put that into a term, a normal physiologic term? Is that dilution or concentration? When ADH is present, come on, when ADH is present, are you going to be diluting your urine, or are you going to be concentrating your urine? There you go, you're going to concentrate your urine, because you're taking free water out of the urine and concentrating it. So when you have inappropriate ADH syndrome, you are always concentrating your urine. When ADH is absent, then what happens? I lose that free water and I dilute my urine. So I've been going into the bathroom, and for all this free water that I've been drinking, I've been peeing it back out because my ADH is suppressed, thank God. But if I had inappropriate ADH syndrome, all this water would stay in my ECF compartment and by osmosis also move into my ICF compartment. The lowest serum sodiums you will ever see are in inappropriate ADH. In fact, I'm going to give you a pearl. On a board exam, part 1, 2, or 3, serum sodium less than 120, it's always inappropriate ADH is the answer. Always. Lowest. Has anyone seen a serum sodium in a live patient less than 100 in this room? I saw one that was 86 at Reading Hospital, Reading, Pennsylvania, not too far from here. 86, alive. So I knew immediately when I was called down as an intern, it was inappropriate ADH. It was just a question of what caused it. And she wasn't a smoker, so she didn't have a small cell carcinoma, so I had to think about medications that can increase ADH. And I found out she was a type 2 diabetic. Okay, yeah, that's right. She was on diabenase or clopropramide. And hopefully you learn from your pharmacology lectures that all oral sulfonylureas, particularly the first generation ones, 30% of the time produce inappropriate ADH. That's what she was on. Okay, so you got to expand your knowledge on inappropriate ADH syndrome beyond small cell cancers and also include drugs and oral sulfonylurea is a big time. We'll talk again about that when we do endocrine, the inappropriate ADH. We're just right now at this point just getting you a concept of tonicity. So here we would have a hypotonic gain of fluid if we were gaining pure water, agreed? Here we'd have a hypertonic loss of salt producing hyponatremia. Okay, here's a situation where you're gaining both water and salt. Ooh, but a little bit more water than salt. And you're still ending up with a hyponatremia. These are your edema states. Okay, your edema states, your kidney edema states. Right heart failure, cirrhosis of the liver, those kinds of things have this scenario where your kidneys are reabsorbing a little bit more water than salt. You end up with a hyponatremia, and you'll end up with pitting edema. I'll just spill the beans on this right now. Your total body sodium, when it's increased, always produces pitting edema. I'm going to ask you a question. What compartment is all the total body sodium in? Come on. ECF, okay. Which one is the biggest compartment? So where is most of your total body sodium? If it was increased, where would most of it be? In your interstitial fluid compartment. And what does sodium always have along with it? I'll rest my case. Whenever you have an increase in total body sodium, most of it is in the interstitial space. That automatically will expand it with a transudate, and you will end up having pitting edema. Period. Okay. So this particular scenario is involved in heart failure, right heart failure, cirrhosis of the liver. This situation. See how just changing the ratios of these things by, a hypertonic loss of salt, like in diuretics, it can get hyponatremia. Gain of pure water, inappropriate ADH, you get hyponatremia, a hypotonic condition. By gaining a little bit more water than salt, we can end up with hyponatremia, a hypotonic condition. All right, hypertonic state, by definition, means you have hypernatremia or what else? hyperglycemia. So any patient that has diabetic ketoacidosis is by definition in a hypertonic condition. And that's certainly more common than hypernatremia. That's very uncommon to see that. Okay, when you have hypernatremia, I want you to tell me, no matter what the cause of it is, what's your ICF compartment look like? Come on, think osmosis, come on. It's shrunken. There you go, very good. So it's always shrunk. So you're thinking small ideas when you have a hypertonic condition. And we can basically just very quickly do these things. You can gain a little bit more salt and water. That's commonly seen in primary aldosteronism. Okay, you can see that situation. Here we can just lose pure water. Well, when we gain pure water, what did we call that disease? Inappropriate ADH. But when we lose pure water, what do we call that disease? Diabetes insipidus. Very good. Whoa! So cool. Good. All right. And you can lose a little bit more water than salt in the urine. Okay? Mixture. Okay? That's called osmotic diuresis. When you have glucose in your urine or mannitol in your urine, you lose a hypotonic salt solution in the urine. Now, guess what baby diarrhea is? It's a hypotonic salt solution. Adult diarrhea is isotonic. Baby diarrhea is hypotonic. So what should, if a baby had no access to water, what should a baby's serum sodium be if they had a rotavirus infection? Come on. It should be high. If you're losing more water than salt, you should have hypernatremia. But what do you think most mommies do that don't know dork about how to take care of a baby with diarrhea? Well, they give them water because the baby's going to be thirsty. So you're going to be filling in that denominator because the baby's getting water. And so that baby can come in maybe with a normal serum sodium, or in some cases, if the baby's really sucking on that water, you can even have hyponatremia because you're filling in the denominator. So I'm going to ask you a question. What should you give the baby if they're losing a hypotonic salt solution? It's called Pedialyte, guys. It's called Pedialyte. What do you think Pedialyte is? What do you think Gatorade is? They are hypotonic salt solutions. And they're basically replacing what you lost. If you're losing a hypotonic salt solution, that's what you give them back, a hypotonic salt solution. Now, here's another board question. You had physiology, is that correct? Well, some of you are a little worried about shaking your heads. Yes. Why? Because I'm going to ask you a question. What has to be in Pedialyte, what has to be in Gatorade for you to reabsorb that sodium in your GI tract? Ah, very good. Why? The co-transport. Sodium has to be reabsorbed with glucose or galactose. Fructose doesn't facilitate its diffusion. That was a board question. I knew it was coming, and it came up in terms of cholera. They asked about, in the oral replacement of patients with cholera, what has to be in that in order for sodium to be reabsorbed? And the answer was glucose. No glucose, no reabsorption of sodium because of the co-transport pump that you learned about in the small intestine. Now, I did check Gatorade. Gatorade has fructose. That's not going to help sodium reabsorption, but it has glucose. And it has sucrose in it, which is converted into two glucoses. No, glucose and a fructose. So that is worth getting. Some of these replenishment things don't have glucose in them. They're absolutely worthless. So you're drinking all this stuff, you're not getting any of the benefit from the salt in them. What do you think sweat is? What do you think the tonicity of sweat is? It's a hypotonic salt solution. So wouldn't that look like this? Sure. So what should you have if you were sweating, let's say, in a hot day, in a marathon run or something like that? What should you have when you cross the finishing line? Hypernatremia. Now, you should know from all of these different scenarios, which are all in your notes, and I'm not going to be going through these things because I think it's more important for me to do acid-base with you, which is poorly taught usually by PhDs. So I'm going to do that, and you can go and learn the volume things. Now, I can understand that. PhDs don't know clinical things. And acid-base is clinical. They usually have it all screwed up. Okay, that's been my experience. I don't know who taught you this. Maybe hopefully they did know what they were talking about, but we'll do that. Okay, so these are the tonicity things. All right. Arterial blood volume. Now, I know that probably who would have done this? Castle will do this, if he already hasn't started on it. Effective arterial blood volume is the same thing as stroke volume and cardiac output. So I just call it EABV, effective arterial blood volume. You must absolutely know, guys, when your cardiac output decreases, all the physiologic mechanisms that happen in your body to restore volume, because it's the most serious condition our body can have. When we get hypovolemic, when we have a decrease in cardiac output, that means that oxygenated blood is not going to get to our tissue. We are going to die. And so volume is supreme in our bodies. Okay, volume is supreme in our bodies. It's absolutely essential. So we need to know what our body does before we get to it and screw it up, which is usually the case. Okay. Why do you think the death rate in hospitals increases after July 1st? Because of the new residents that come in. That's an absolute known fact, that the first three, that is the worst time to ever go to the hospital. If you're a patient, never go to the hospital in the first 3 months after July. July, August, September. Because they all die. Because what does a resident know? That's a person that just came out of medical school. What do they really know about things? Nothing. I didn't know dork. And I was on duty the first day in the Reading Hospital in Pennsylvania. I was on duty for medicine. Bad place to put me. Because yes, what did I pray that I would not have? A cardiorespiratory arrest. So there was one. Not only one, two. And I was on duty in a 700-bed hospital, me and Avella, the two of us. Same school, Temple Medical School, Philadelphia. That's where I went. Okay, what did I know about cardiorespiratory arrest? Nothing! I don't know how. Thank God for the nurses. What do I do now? You do this, doctor. What do I do now? You do this, doctor. Thank God for the nurses. Holy smokes. They both survived. They both survived. I didn't know anything. I even called up Avella. Help me, you come with me. I know it's my turn, but come. What do we do now? We don't know, what do we know? Give him this doctor. Okay, oh, jeez. After 3 months, though, after a number of those things, we kind of figured it out, and then people started living. Okay? It was nice, because we're not supposed to do harm to patients, but not those first 3 months. It's horrible. This is the truth. You don't know anything. Not only that, you're responsible because you have an MD degree. Horrible. Well, whatever. All right, now, we have baroreceptors. We have low pressure ones and high pressure ones. The low pressure ones are on the venous side, the high pressure ones are on the arterial side, like carotids and arches of the aorta. Okay, they're usually innervated by the 9th and 10th nerve. The high-pressure ones. Now, when you have a decrease in arterial blood volume, in other words, a decrease in stroke volume or cardiac output, you underfill the arch vessels and the carotid. And so instead of having a vagus and 10th nerve type of a response, 9th and 10th nerve response, you have a sympathetic nervous tissue response. And so catecholamines are released. We want catecholamines when our stroke volumes decrease, because what is it going to do to the venous system? Constricted, you're going to get venoconstriction, which is going to increase blood returning to your right side of the heart. That's good. You want that. You certainly don't want venal dilation, because that's going to pull it in your legs. Okay, what's it going to do to your heart with all those beta adrenergic receptors? Increase the force of contraction. Great. That's going to increase my stroke volume a little bit, not much. Okay, but my systolic will go up a little bit and increase my rate, my chronotropic part, my heart rate will increase. That's both of those are good. Okay, right? What's going to happen to my arterioles on the systemic side? Well, it's going to stimulate the beta receptors in the smooth muscle. Remember, what is your diastolic pressure really due to? It's really due to the amount of blood that's in your arterial system while your heart is filling up in diastole. Who controls the amount of blood that is in the arterial system when your heart is filling up in diastole? Your peripheral resistance arterioles are. That's what maintains your diastolic blood pressure. Whoa! So when they're constricted, then there's very little blood going to tissue. So yeah, the bad news is the tissues are not going to get a whole lot of blood. The good news is you're going to keep your diastolic pressure up. Well, why wouldn't that be good? When do your coronary arteries fill, guys? In diastole. So someone's got to get screwed when you're in a bad situation. Okay? So the peripheral resistance arterioles constrict. All of that's done by catecholamines without us even being there. And then for free, it stimulates the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system sympathetically. So renin's going to be released. Angiotensin 2 is going to be present. What does angiotensin 2 do? It's a vasoconstrictor of the peripheral resistance arterioles, so it's helping along the catecholamines. And then angiotensin 2 stimulates 18-hydroxylase, which Dr. Porter taught you, converts corticosterone into aldosterone. Okay, that's what angiotensin 2 does. And it stimulates aldosterone release. What's aldosterone going to do for us in this situation? Reabsorb salt and water. That's the most important thing so far, salt and water, to get our cardiac output up. And aldosterone is doing that. So that's all catecholamines. And of course, if the stroke volume's decreased, then what's the renal blood flow to the kidneys? Decreased. Is that a stimulus also for the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system? Sure. And where exactly are those the receptors for that, for the juxtaglomerular apparatus? Exactly where, please? The afferent arteriole. It has sensors in it. They're basically modified smooth muscle cells that sense blood flow. And so we're going to get a little help there. Antidiuretic hormone will be released. Now that's not so cool, because what's that going to contribute? Just pure water. Is that going to help my cardiac output to increase pure water, or do I want salt to increase my cardiac output? What do I want? Let me just ask you a question. If I was bleeding to death here, let's say I cut my wrist here and I was bleeding to death out here and I lost 3 liters of fluid out there. All of you are saying, get a doctor, and a lot of you are doctors. And you'll be just milling around me watching me bleed to death. Okay? Meanwhile, you call 911, there's all these doctors in here. Okay? Pathologist is already going to put a Y-shaped incision on me already here. Okay? He's going to be just checking me out with a Y-shaped incision. Right? The rest of you say, don't touch him, get him, 911. You might have germs. All right. So I'm dying. Then finally they come. Okay, how are they going to keep my blood pressure up, guys? They don't have blood there. Normal saline. Normal saline is isotonic. And what compartment is it going to stay in? My ECF compartment. Basically, normal saline is plasma without the protein. That's basically what it is. Isn't it true that any time you have hypovolemic shock from any cause, you can keep a patient's blood pressure up with normal saline just fine? Because normal saline is what stays in your ECF compartment. You couldn't raise my blood pressure with half normal saline. You couldn't keep it up with 5% dextrose and water. It's worthless. To keep my blood pressure up, you have to give me something that resembles plasma and has the same tonicity as plasma. That's what normal saline is. 0.9%. That was actually on part one, that question, too. So ADH will be released also. That's a nerve response. Okay, now, I hope you learn in renal physiology about peritubular capillary pressures. Not really. I'll bet you did. Okay, where did you learn where you reabsorb most sodium in your kidney, in your nephron? There we go. It's the proximal tubule. You see, you learned something. 60 to 80% of sodium is reabsorbed in the proximal tubule. That's correct. Where's the rest of it reabsorbed? Distal and collecting tube by who? Aldosterone. Okay, so most of it went up the proximal tube. But here's what maybe some of you never think about, like me. So I learned about this. Reabsorb it into what? Peritubular capillaries. That's nice. Well, but in order for them to reabsorb all that salt-containing fluid or anything that it reabsorbs out of the proximal tubule, these Starling's forces in those peritubular capillaries have to be amenable to it. Right? So I'm going to ask you a question. You have two Starling's forces. You have oncotic pressure that likes to keep fluids in a vessel. We have hydrostatic pressure that pushes fluid out of the vessel. Is that correct? Okay. If your renal blood flow is decreased to your kidney, when your stroke volume and cardiac output is decreased, what happens to your peritubular capillary hydrostatic pressure? It decreases. So if that's decreasing, what's increasing? Your peritubular oncotic pressure, and that is what's responsible for your reabsorbing anything into your bloodstream from the kidney. Woo. So that's why I have PO, oncotic pressure peritubular capillary, is greater than pH, hydrostatic pressure. That's what allows you to reabsorb all that salt-containing fluid from your proximal tubule back into your bloodstream. Okay? So if we add up all the types of fluids that the kidney is going to be reabsorbing in a patient that has a decrease in cardiac output, any cause you want, guys, cardiogenic shock, hypovolemic shock, I don't give a hoot and holler what it's causing. Okay, this happens automatically. Every patient. Okay? So, does anyone know what the tonicity of the fluid is that you reabsorb out of the proximal tubule, the salt? It's roughly isotonic. So that's good. That's just like giving in normal saline. So let's put 2 or 3 liters of that in here, okay, just this cup, that the proximal tubule is reabsorbing because the peritubular oncotic is greater than hydrostatic pressure. But what is ADA? What is aldosterone reabsorbing? What is aldosterone? From the renin-angiotensin, what is that reabsorbing? Roughly isotonic salt solution, but not near as much as the proximal tubule. So let's put a liter of that in there. Those are all very nice things to have in our bloodstream. But what's ADH contributing? Pure water. Ooh. So let's put 2 liters of pure water into this cup, the ECF compartment. So when you add that all up now, you have all this isotonic saline reabsorbed, but now you're adding pure water. What is the tonicity happening? It becomes a little bit hypotonic. So that's what the kidney normally reabsorbs back into our ECF compartment when we have a decrease in cardiac output. Okay. This is all must-know stuff, this stuff here, because this is normal physiologic response to a decrease in cardiac output from any cause. Now, what if you had just the opposite? Your stroke volume was increased. Your arterial blood volume was increased. Okay? What would happen there? Well, just the absolute reverse. The baroreceptors are now going to be stretched. They're innervated by the 9th and 10th nerve. And so we're not going to get a sympathetic nervous system response. We're going to get a parasympathetic response. We're not going to have venoconstriction and an increase in force of contraction of the heart or anything like that. The object is we're fluid overloaded, get rid of it. The renin-angiotensin aldosterone system is not going to be activated with increased renal blood flow. So that's not going to be there. Your ADH is not going to be invited because you have volume overload, it actually decreases its release. Your peritubular hydrostatic pressure in those capillaries is higher than oncotic pressure, so even if you reabsorb the salt, you are not able to reabsorb it back into your bloodstream because it wouldn't get in there, you'd pee it out. And so you will lose a hypotonic fluid in your urine when you have an increase in arterial blood volume. These are all normal things that you must know. What happens when you have a decrease in cardiac output, all the physiologic responses, what happens when you have an increase? There's also a certain hormone made in your left and right atrium that will be released if you have dilatation of right or left atrium. And what is that? Atrial natriuretic peptide, and what is that going to get rid of? No? Well, it'll cut off ADH, but what does it also get rid of? It's natriuretic, guys. Okay, it'll get rid of salt. This guy actually acts as a diuretic. Atrial natriuretic peptide is only released in volume overloaded states. Okay, it's not released when you have a hypovolemic condition. No way, Jose. It's only when those atrium, either right or left, are dilated with excess fluid. That's when it's released. So these are normal things that you need to know. Okay, here's a boy question for you. Problem. Moo. Okay. Patient given 3% hypertonic saline. Then they have this little chart down here where they had p-osm on the y-axis and they had serum ADH on the x-axis. And they had these little dumb letters, A, B, C, and D. Okay, now in your book, I put a little square in the middle. That represents normal. Okay? All right, so 3% hypertonic saline. What would that do to the osmolality? What are you adding to the patient? a hypertonic salt solution. What has to happen to the osmolality? Increase. So you know the answer is either going to be B or C. You know that automatically. Okay? So, if you have an increase in p-osm, what would that do to the serum ADH? It increases it. Remember, an increase in osmolality of plasma or serum causes a release of ADH. Okay, so then we'd have to go over, well, ADH goes from low to high, and so C is the answer. And this was a board question. But because I'm so nice to you, I actually put what A and B and D would also be in a normal situation. Why? Because if they use this chart for that question, well, then they'll use this chart for diabetes insipidus. They'll use this chart for inappropriate ADH. Let's do inappropriate ADH. Okay. What's the plasma osmolality in inappropriate ADH syndrome? Low, so you know that it's either A or D. Okay. And what about ADH levels? High. So is it A or is it D is the answer? D, there you go. How about diabetes insipidus? That's no ADH. Okay? So what does that do to serum sodium? It goes high, so it's either going to be B or C. And what's the ADH levels? Low. So which answer is it? D is correct.
Very good! See how easy this is? It is when you do it, but then I get it as a problem and I get all confused. Welcome to the club. Make it sound so simple. Then I get home and I say, I got this, and I look at it, and what did he say? I'm all confused.
Okay, and then in your confusion, you try to read something, you get all anxious, all angry, and you get mad at yourself. Does that pretty well describe it? We're all there. We all had that problem. So get over it. If you understood it now, basically you do understand it. It's there. Trust me on that. All right, so here's this thing again, and I promised you that I would tell you how you can tell what the total body sodium is in the patient. Well, you're going to tell me. I'm going to show you two pictures. This person, I want you to look at the tongue. And this person, I want you to look at those indentations in the skin. Okay, what's the total body sodium in this patient with the dry tongue? Decreased. What's the total body sodium in that patient? Hi. Physical exam tells you. Mayo Clinic proceedings said it is a very accurate way of telling total body sodium. Physical exam. So what you call dehydration, you know about skin turgor? When you pinch the skin, okay, and it goes up and see how mine went down real easy? Do you know that when you pinched my skin like that and it went down, that says that my total body sodium is normal? You're basically testing what your total body sodium is in your interstitial space by pinching the skin. That's what skin turgor tells you. So that's very important to do, except that old people, they all have it, you know. So they want to use something like the chest or the back or something like that. And then looking in the mouth and looking at the mucous membranes. So all those things you know about for dehydration, if they're present, you can assume that total body sodium is decreased. If none of them are there, you can assume total body sodium is normal. If you have pinning edema, dependent pinning edema in a patient, total body sodium absolutely is increased. Absolutely, unequivocally. Okay? So that's how you can tell the total body sodium in a patient by physical examination. Very important. So I'm going to ask you just a couple questions. If I had inappropriate ADH and I'm gaining pure water, what's my total body sodium? Normal. But what's my serum sodium concentration? Low. What would I have to restrict? Water, okay? I have right heart failure and I have dependent pinning edema like that dude on the right. Okay? What did I say was the fluid that the kidney reabsorbs when your cardiac output's decreased? Hypotonic salt solution. A little bit more water than salt. Put that into the serum sodium formula. A little bit more water than salt. Okay, what's your serum sodium going to be? Low. Okay, what's in the numerator? Was the numerator increased with total body sodium? Yes. But in the denominator, they had a greater increase in total body water. Is that correct? I'm going to ask you a simple question like they did on part one boards. What's your non-pharmacologic treatment of any of the edema states, like heart failure and cirrhosis? Restrict salt, restrict water. What's your treatment for inappropriate ADH? restrict water. What's your treatment for any pitting edema state? Restrict salt, restrict water. Isn't that correct? That's all you need to know for part one. In terms of that. You have to restrict salt and water. Now, what would your pharmacologic treatment be if you had a pitting edema state? Diuretics. That's going to help get rid of a little bit more of the salt and also lose some water at the same time. But your non-pharmacologic treatment is restrict salt, restrict water. Why? Because you know you have an increase in total body water, so you got to restrict water, and you have an increase in total body sodium, so you have to restrict sodium. It's just that simple, guys. It's just that simple. And that's good enough for part one to get a lot of questions right. Okay, that's enough on that. Shock! Some of you are in shock right now, so I don't even have to teach you about it. I mean, that's going to be just something. Well, let me see how I feel right now. I'm cold and clammy, but all right. Can you give me some causes of hypovolemic shock just to make sure we're all talking in the same wavelength here? How about diarrhea? Could that produce diarrhea? Yeah, cholera produces hypovolemic shock. How about blood loss? Sure, that can do it. How about sweating? Oh, yeah, that can produce hypovolemic shock. How about diabetes insipidus? No. What are you losing? Pure water. What's your total body sodium? Normal. You are not in hypovolemic shock. You couldn't be in hypovolemic shock if your life depended on it. We're losing pure water. You're going to feel sick. Yeah. Because you're going to be shifting blood, fluid out of your ICF compartment. You're going to be thirsty as all get out. But you're not going to be hypovolemic because all you're losing is pure water. Where would you be losing most of that pure water from? The ICF compartment. You'll have a perfectly normal exam in a patient with diabetes and said, is this going to be thirsty? You can't have it. You won't have no signs of dehydration whatsoever by losing just pure water. None. It's the salt that's important. You lose just a little bit of salt, and all of a sudden you are hypovolemic. Here's a test that they actually had on part one. Okay, and make sure that you know this one because it was a sample question that the USMLE sent out, and I happened to answer it for Kaplan. Right at the answer. It was a young lady that had a hypovolemic shock, and they asked how you treated the patient. You know, what would you treat her with? Okay, and here's what they put in the stem of the question, so you know they can ask it on part one because it was a sample question they've already given out. They said that when she was lying down, her blood pressure was normal and her pulse was normal. When they sat her up, the blood pressure went down and the pulse went up. What does that mean? That means they're volume depleted, guys. That's called the tilt test. You better know the tilt test. Why was the patient's blood pressure and pulse normal lying down? No effect of gravity, guys. Okay, you're lying flat, and so you had a reasonable amount of blood returning to the right side of the heart and then left side of the heart, and was able to maintain your cardiac output. Everything was fine. But when you sit the patient up, you decrease, by imposing gravity, you decrease the venous return to the right side of your heart. And so if you're hypovolemic, it'll show up by a decrease in blood pressure and an increase in pulse. All those things we just talked about when your cardiac output's decreased. And what was it due to? Catecholamine effect. Blood pressure went down, pulse went up. Or another way they could do it is they could say that you have, let's say, 100 over 80 blood pressure and a 110 pulse lying down. You sat them up, they get a 70 over 50 blood pressure, the pulse is 150. Is that a difference? What does it mean? It means you're severely hypovolemic. It's called the tilt test. That was actually in the stem of the question on a part one USMLE sample question. See, they give away ideas when they give out those sample things. Any good educator would know, you know, what they think is important by that, something like that. Okay, what was your first step? In fact, the answer was, what they were asking was, how would you treat the patient? And they had half normal saline down there. They had normal saline down there. They had 5% dextrose and water and some other retarded things. What was the answer? Normal saline was the answer. Okay, so that was the answer to that one. So let's break for 10 minutes. Mm-hmm.